This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Pinchas Nadler in honor of Yidel Gluck and Gluck Plumbing for their professional and quality work that they've done and continue to do for him and his business, as well as the support of the podcast and sponsorship of various episodes, especially the Shopsite Tzvi series, and as well as the upcoming series on Spanish Jewry, which has to do with the Jews of Spain, their origins, the riots of 1391, the Spanish Inquisition, the expulsion of 1492, Portugal 1497, conversos, crypto Jews, and so on. If anyone else wants to sponsor an episode of the podcast, wants to support the podcast, either on the website, I'll put it in the show's notes. There's a link via PayPal, as well as you can email me, svarimchatter@gmail.com. Also, if anyone uses Apple Podcasts, if you can please subscribe, and also it would be a real help if you can rate and review the podcast.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Svarim Chatter podcast. On this episode of the podcast, I'm going to be joined once again by Rav Moshe Maimon, who has been a guest of the podcast, most recently about his commentary, Rabbeinu Avraham ben Rambam, Ala Toira, and we also discussed the Makal Tov of the Chidah and a number of other things. This episode, as teased in the last episode about Rabbeinu Avraham ben Rambam, is going to be about the commentary of Rav David HaNogid, who is this Rav David HaNogid II, the great-grandson, I think, of Rav Rambam and Rambam, so a descendant of the Rambam, and his commentary on Chumash, which we have very little of, but Rav Moshe recently published in the journal Mechilta, in the fourth edition of Mechilta. He published this commentary on Parshas Ve'era. So this week's Parshas Ve'era, we are doing this episode, therefore, for Parshas Ve'era. So thank you, Rav Moshe, for joining me once again.
Thank you very much, Nachi. Always a pleasure. And after the last episode, especially, the feedback was so positive, and you have quite an intelligent audience. And it's a pleasure and an honor for me to be able to spend some more time with them. Thank you very much.
Okay, and I will mention here also that the episodes that you come on have great numbers, so the listeners seem to enjoy hearing you, and especially the listeners, as far as I can tell, and people can correct me otherwise, or email me or you, they seem to enjoy hearing about commentaries on Chumash, especially Rishayim, and they like hearing about things on Chumash. So, okay, let's talk about Rav David HaNogid. I know we did discuss him a little bit in the last episode, but let's start fresh. This is his own episode, so to speak. I mentioned he's the second one, so let's talk a little bit about his genealogy. I mean, and who was he? Where was he born? His basic biography.
All right, so let me share what we know about his biography. His biography, the definitive biography to this point, has been written by Reb Reuven Margolius at the end of his biography on Reb Avraham ben Rambam. I say the definitive biography because he did an excellent job collecting all the printed sources that were available then, including some manuscript sources that he was aware of. And even though there's been a lot of work done in recent decades, on different works of Rav David HaNogid, but not a lot of new biographical information has come to light. So it's somewhat thumbnail. It's a little bit sparse, but what we do know was put together by like I said, Rav Margolius, and this is the basic outline. He's the last in the chain of the Negidim. Negidim was the term that was given, it's a political term for the communal leader of the Egyptian Jews. It was a government recognized position. It was first held by the Rambam, although the term Nugid most likely was not used at that time, but the position was, that was the Rambam's position. After the Rambam, his son Rav Avram, who for all appearances seems to be his only son, Ben Yachid, he yarshened his father's position. That's Rav Avram Ben Rambam, the author of the Pirush on Chumash that I worked on. After Reb Avram, there was Reb David I, Reb David HaNogid, young, he was young at the time of his father's untimely death, about 20 or so, but he served in this position for a very long time. He lived a long life. He was in the position for about 60 years or so, very beloved figure on his congregation. He was friendly with the Rajba. The Rajba mentions him in a tshuva during the controversy over the Rambam's writings. He writes about his great friendship. He said, you know, there's nothing personal in the position he takes because he was so friendly with the Rambam's grandson, Reb David HaNogid. This Reb David HaNogid was a very prolific darshan. And he authored what we have today as the Medrash Reb David HaNogid. maybe not in the form that we have it today, but he did put together, Midrashim, which is, the Darshan's handbook. He collected all the different Midrashim, including those, some of which we don't have today. Some of those same, Midrashim that served as the basis for Medrash HaGadol were used by him. So it's an agadic work, but it's extensive. It covers all the Parshias. It covers the Mayadim, Pirkei Avos. That was his bread and butter. He was an excellent Darshan, like I said, and he would preach every Shabbos afternoon. And his drushes were very, very popular in Mitzrayim and in Yemen. And they were copied. Those survived in numerous, numerous manuscripts in the Gniza and in circulation. So that's what he is most famous for. Not a lot of work outside of that. But we do have his Midrashim, or at least a work based on his Midrashim. Reb David, after he passed away, he was succeeded by his son, Reb Avram II. Reb Avram II, we don't have a lot by way of what he left behind, but he did serve in the Negidus with distinction. And when he died, it went to his youngest son, Rabbi Yehoshua HaNagid. Rabbi Yehoshua HaNagid, we do have his tshuvas on the Rambam and on Sefer HaMitzvahs. Those are quoted by the Kesef Mishnah. Rabbi Yehoshua HaNagid was also had an influence all the way to Yemen, who always had an affinity for the Rambam's family. And when Rabbi Yehoshua died, he was taken over by his son, Reb David II. So when we talk in this podcast about Reb David HaNagid, we are going to be referring to, we'll just call him Reb David HaNagid, but I guess just to be clear, it's Reb David HaNagid II. He's Reb David, the son of Reb Yehoshua HaNagid, as opposed to Reb David, the son of Reb Avram Ben Aramba. So that's this Reb David HaNagid. He was born in Egypt in 1335. And he also took over at a young age. He was just about 20 years old when Rabbi Yehoshua died in 1355, and he took over the position. Now, for some reason, and we still don't know, but about 20 years later, he leaves Egypt. He stops off in Eretz Yisrael, and then he goes to Syria. Now, Eretz Yisrael is on the way to Syria from Egypt. And even in Egypt, and even, I'm sorry, even in Syria, he does occupy a position of distinction. He's still referred to as Nugget by people who meet him, and they refer to him with great respect. But we do not know exactly the reasons for him leaving, although we do have a letter that he wrote to his community. It may have been government pressure. We simply don't know. This Reb David HaNagid brought with him to Syria a very extensive library. And this we mentioned in the last podcast, that this library included writings of the Rambam, writings of Reb Avram ben Arambam, other writings that he had collected in Diktuk, works of Reb Tanachum Yerushalmi, and such, and so on and so forth, and his own extensive writings as well.
So, Reb David, I mean, I guess this question applies to all of the Negidim, but let's focus on Reb David here. Did he learn by his father, Reb Yeshua? Do we know who his Rebbeim were, where he learned from, who he learned by?
Very little is known about the structure of yeshivas in Mitzrayim. We do know that the Rambam himself gave shiurim because we have some notes. You know, Reb Avram gave shiurim because they had, also there were some notes from Talmidim published by Mordechai Akiva Friedman and others. So we do know that there was some semblance of formal instruction. The main limud we do know was the Sefer of the Rambam. The Rambam took, the place of, that was the, well, the way we would approach the Gemara today or the Rif, by them it was, they would learn the Chibur. The Chibur means the Rambam's Mishnah Torah. So that was central to their learning. Of course, Reb David HaNagid, Talmid HaChamim, like the Negidim, do show also proficiency in the Gemaras, and then they refer to the Gemaras, and they will try to explain how the Rambam learned the Gemara. But it was their Bekiyas in Rambam, which made them famous, of course. That's, the people in Yemen writing to Rabbi Yehoshua HaNagid were always writing about the Rambam. So exactly who they learned by, most likely they learned, Ish Mipi Ish from Rabbi Yehoshua, probably was Reb David HaNagid's Rebbe. And there's no documentation of that, but it's fair to assume that that was the system at the time.
Interesting, you say that on the Rambam. I mean, that's what the Rambam says in Mishnah Torah, the Ravid's famous tying on him. So that's kind of, that's about what they did. Now you went to Syria, you say. So, do we know what position he occupied, what he did in Syria, and also when did he die?
We don't know specifically what the position was, but we do have an interesting encounter with him by the author of what some people consider the best super commentary on the Ibn Ezra, written by Rabbi Yosef Tov Elim, who had he had lived in Toledo in Spain, and then he had gone to Jerusalem, and he eventually came to Syria as well, where he met up, interestingly, not in Aleppo, where Reb David HaNugid originally went. He writes that he met Reb David HaNugid in Damascus. And so apparently Reb David had moved. We don't know why, but he does seem to have spent some time in Damascus as well. And Reb Yosef Tov Elim, when he meets Reb David HaNugid, Reb David quickly becomes aware that his guest is in it has tremendous proficiency in Ibn Ezra to astonishing degree, and he says, you have to write a commentary in Ibn Ezra. And Rabbi Yosef writes, I didn't want to, he had reasons not to, but he says, but I was talking to a Nugid Yisrael, I was talking to a prince in Israel, I couldn't turn him down. I was not able to aim a sarvin the gadol. I could not turn down his request, so he felt compelled to do it, and that's why we have this pirish. So again, it is clear that he occupied a position of distinction and prestige. Was it political or not? We don't know. We simply don't have that information. And that's why I mentioned that there's still a dearth of biographical information, even with the passage of so much time. That has still remains to be clarified. We know he was alive in 1409, that the Geniza did yield the documents, which refers to him, again, as the Nugid HaNegidim and the Rosh Yeshiva Sashal Kaira, which, again, it's a term which shows that he did give Shiurim an instruction in learning as well. Again, where was that, and how formal was that position? We just don't know. We do know he was alive at the time. More than that, we don't know. There is a report, it hasn't been established as true. Maybe some degree of legend, we don't know. But there's a report that his children, two sons, were captured and carried off of captivity during the upheavals of 1401. Again, I don't know if that's true or not, but it is clear that his writings and his large library did remain in Syria, where they were fortuitously redeemed by the mission, that we spoke about last time. And that's why a large amount of them did land up in public libraries, where they exist till this very day.
So I want to talk more about his writings in a minute. So you mentioned Rabbi Yosef Tov Elim. So Rabbi Yosef Tov Elim HaSfaradi, right, is a Sfaradi one. And yep. He also, the commentary is called Sofras Penach, right? I don't know if you mentioned.
Right.
And
yes, I did.
This story he writes in the commentary?
Yeah, it's an introduction to the commentary.
Okay, so that's what I wanted to just clarify. Okay, so Rabbi David HaNugid, what about his writings? You want to go a little bit more specific about his writings?
So he left over a wide variety of writings. Again, he wrote commentaries on the Rambam's works. He wrote a commentary on the Mishnah Torah, at least the beginning part of it, and he wrote extensively. So the portion of his commentary dealing with the Tefillah section in Ahava of the Rambam includes a complete commentary on the Siddur. The Rambam included the Siddur in a truncated version. So he wrote a commentary on the Siddur as part of his Pirish on Mishnah Torah. That Pirish on the Siddur did survive. I know Rabbi Yehuda Zeivald is working on publishing it now. So Amir Tashem, that'll be available hopefully before too long. That should be very, very interesting. I know I've used the manuscript myself in my work. He quotes sources that we don't have. And of course he adds, including pieces of Rabbi Avraham Rambam's Sefer HaMasbik that are missing, and Reb Sadiglin, et cetera, et cetera. So that should be a very valuable work when that arrives. He wrote a commentary on the Bar Nevuchim that did not survive. Fragments of it did survive, including a reference to it in the work that I published in Mechilta, which we'll get to soon. In addition to commentaries on the Rambam's work, he wrote his own independent works. He wrote works of Musar, works of philosophy. One of the, I guess we would call it a Musar / Chassidus work, is the Moira HaPrishus that was published by Mekitz and Erdom in the 80s, edited by Professor Fenton. That's it kind of follows somewhat along the lines of the mystical parts or the Chassidus parts of Sefer HaMaspik. It includes a program for his Hisbaydidus, the Sefer was actually republished by Breslov because, they totally independent of the Hasidei Mitzrayim who practice his Baidadis, similar to the Islamic Hasidim of the time. But independent of them, Breslov developed also a program of his Baidadis, and they found that there's this Chibur written in Mitzrayim 400 years earlier. They jumped in and they actually reprinted this work, the Meir HaPrishus. Besides for that, Reb David also wrote, he says, this we know in his introduction to his Pirush on Chumash, he writes, I already wrote in Arabic drushes that the Hamoyin masses can enjoy, drushes that the Darshan can use on Shabbos. So now he's turning his attention to a Pirush on Chumash for Chachamim, which he's writing in Hebrew. And that's the paper we're going to get to soon. That's the Klil HaYoifi, his Pirush on Chumash. But recently, I just wanted to mention regarding the drushes, Rabbi Zeivald has recently published from manuscripts editions of some of these drushes, and he has put forth a theory which is somewhat interesting because it's never been firmly established the degree to which the drushes are actually written by Rabbi David Hanoga the First. Like we mentioned earlier, he did have drushes, and the drushes we have are likely built on those drushes, but to what degree are they actually his, we didn't know. And according to the early results from Rabbi Zeivald's research, it appears that the Reb David Hanoge the First, his drushes were later worked over by Reb David Hanoge the Second. So when Reb David Hanoge refers to drushes that he had written, he may be referring to drushes that he had edited from his forebear with the same name, and those are the drushes. But it's not, more work still has to be done on that. A lot of the drushes still remain in manuscript, and there's lots of manuscripts, and there's variances. Is in fact a work, an academic work written just categorizing and cataloging all the many different manuscripts on drushes of David HaNugget. So there's still work to be done in that regard. But what we're going to talk about tonight is his Pirush on Chumash L'Derech HaPshat, which he titled Klil HaYoifi, and he wrote it in Hebrew. That's what we're going to talk about.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the Klil HaYoifi, and we'll talk more about manuscript things, this kind of boring things for those that are interested in that at the end. So, as you mentioned, it's called Klil HaYoifi. Why is it called that? Why did he call it that, do we know? And also, wrote in Hebrew, which is interesting. The Rambam, a lot of his things are not. Obviously, Mishoter is, but a lot of other things are not. The Rambam and the Rambam wrote in Arabic, so was that just, he lived a few centuries later, so he was, at that point, it was more in style to write in Hebrew, or does he explain why he wrote this in Hebrew, not in Arabic?
He does, well, like I said, he references the fact that it was written for a smaller audience. The reason the Rambam wrote his, he wrote in Judeo-Arabic, was because that was the vernacular. That's what people spoke, and he wanted it to be read by the common people instead of just the rabbis. You know, the situation may be similar. I like to tell people, I don't know how apt the analogy is, but it's similar to Europe pre-yeshivas, where you had the rav in each town that was a tremendous Talmud Chacham. You had a small circle of scholars that would gather around him, but the vast majority of the inhabitants, you know, despite their great piety, were unlettered. A lot of them couldn't read. They were really, really, amayorit. So to reach the masses, you had to write in a language in the Judeo-Arabic. And Reb Sadia Goyen, he wrote his Pirushim in Judeo-Arabic for the same reason, to reach the common people. So Reb David HaNugget writes that his drushes that he had worked on, that he had written, that he had edited, were written in Arabic because they were to be appreciated by everybody. But this crowning glory, I guess that's the name, Klil HaYoifi means, we don't have the full introduction, so it's somewhat fragmented. I don't remember if he addresses specifically the name, why he gave it this name, but apparently this was more limited, of a more limited scope. This was for rabbinical scholars that want, you know, had access to the source material in Hebrew, were studying original Hebrew sources and would appreciate a work geared for them in Hebrew. That's what the Klil HaYoifi is.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about the style of this commentary.
This commentary is, by and large, a likut. He writes that it's a likut l'derech ha-pshat. He's largely going to be talking about pshat. He will comment on agada. He'll comment on, Musar when it comes up. But the main focus, he says, is going to be the pshat of the psukim. And therefore, he was going to call from sources that deal with, primarily, that deal with pshat, And he is the editor. He deftly navigates between the Pirushim, saying this is like that, or that's another one, or the question that he raised, you might answer like this based on something another person said. But largely, he quotes verbatim at length citations from the other, you know, very rich source material that he had. And it's rich even by today's definitions. It was very varied and very extensive and includes a lot of sources which I lost, which we'll get into later. But it's a very long pirush. The parts that remain are extensive, and they cover relatively small amounts of the Chumash. There's more than 100 pages in manuscript on Parshas Bereishis, which doesn't cover the whole Parshas Bereishis. So it's 100 pages on, you know, about a parak or so of Parshas Bereishis. The manuscript that I was working with, that fragment, was about 8 pages or so, again, also on less than a parak, of Parshas Va'eras. Now, of course, Bereishis is bigger because it covers the fundamentals. So, but even Va'eri, we can tell just it's long. And he quotes the sources. He quotes them at length, and he was very careful in his citations. He had access to different versions of some like Ibn Ezra. He quotes from the Pirush in our Makoreis Gedolos, that's the one he used, which is today known as the Pirush Ha'aruch, the long Pirush. It's the later edition that the Ibn Ezra wrote. That's his main Pirush, but he also had access to the Pirush HaKatzer, which was only published in the 1900s. You know, it had survived the manuscript only and largely unknown to a lot of scholars. But the Reb Dovid HaNogid had that variance. He calls it the Nusach Acher and compares it, and his citations are very accurate. So we have a lot to learn from his variant readings as well. So that's the kind of pirush it is. It's long, it's verbatim, and it's rishonim and kadmonim l'derech hapshat.
So you say that he's focused on derech hapshat here in this pirush. What do you mean by that?
David lived in a time before Rashi's pirush was, I guess you might say, canonized, like it has been today, as recent current events may show. Before that time, it was understood. But again, this has no disclaimer. This has no relevance for anything going on today. But at that time, it was a different time. And at that time, Rashi was, especially in the area where Reb Dovid operated, Rashi was seen as a kind of a midrashic compendium with an emphasis on pshat. But he would call from midrashim. He would explain the psukim according to the way the Medrash explains the Psukim, not a way the Pshat explains the Psukim. What do I mean by Pshat? Pshat would be, very often it's in line with the Targum Unklus. It's the way Reb Sadia Glein approached the Psukim. Sometimes it's the way the Taimei HaMikra show the Psukim. It's a stripped down meaning of the Pasuk, meaning without all the interpretations mentioned in Chazal, mentioned in the Midrashim. Usually the plain, the simple, straightforward reading of the pasuk that you would understand without having recourse to the midrashim, and that's the way the kadmonim, particularly the kadmonim, the goyim and the Spanish rishonim, that is the way they approach the psukim. That's the way Avraham ben Rambam, like we spoke last time, understood the psukim. That's the way the Rambam understood the psukim when he outside of Mishnah Torah, where he was writing on his own, and that's what Reb Dovid HaNogid focuses as well.
So just glancing at the Pirush, he does quote Gemaras, he does deal with a couple of Gemaras. Does he deal at all with any Midrashim or none?
He does. He will quote Midrashim when he feels that they have a very profound meaning, that the scholar who's, again, like I said, the Drash they felt was primarily for instruction. Instruction for the masses, guidance for the masses, inspiration for the masses. That was the function of Drush in this corner of the world. That's how they looked at Drush, which is why they felt Drush has great importance and great value, but pedagogical value and inspirational value, like we said, and that was geared more towards the masses. But the scholar was focused more on understanding the Pshat, because the scholar understood that that's the way the Chazal themselves understood the Psukim. They, like what we spoke in the last episode, that was their conviction, that Chazal themselves learned L'derech HaPshat and just gave the Midrashim for the aforementioned purposes. So that's the focus here as well. And so he will cite Midrashim when he feels there is special interest for the scholar. There's a lesson to be learned, or shed light on the general background of what was going on, particularly in Sefer Bereishis, where Parshas Bereishis, where there is so much going on besides for just the meaning of the psukim. So he does cite midrashim, and you may be interested to know he is one of the earliest maybe the earliest in Mitzrayim, in Egypt, who quotes the Sefer HaZayar, quotes it freely. And in fact, that's something unique about him, which we can get to soon. But he quotes from Zayar, he quotes from other Kabbalistic works, other Agadic works. So he does, but the primary focus is the Pshat, as he says so himself.
Okay, now how about compared to just his ancestors, the Rambam, how does he, I mean, they're obviously, we can talk about this, they're quoted quite extensively in here, but does he like compare to them?
It's interesting. His own input is marginal. You know, he's, like I said, it's more editorial, his own insights. He's not aiming to give you his own understanding. As an aside, in the introduction, I noted that another publication claims to be from this Sefer Klal Yefi, Rabbi Yehuda Zeval, published a very important, otherwise very important fragment on Parshas B'Shalach, which is quite interesting. But you know, while Rabbi Zeval believed that was part of the Klal HaYofi, I argued in my introduction that it can't be, because it's such a different kind of commentary. And that commentary that he published is very independent, very strong-minded. It's not at all like the Klal HaYofi, which is primarily Alikud, like Rabbi David says. You know, he's setting out to write. He's writing Alikud. So I believe it, you know, for other reasons as well, which I enumerated in there. I don't want to get into now. But it's a very different kind of peerage. This peerage is largely not his own words. It's just he's just serving as the tour guide. You know, he's navigating, showing you the way around, but not giving you a lot of his own opinion. So his input and his relationship to the Rambam will be compared by how he cites and who he cites. And maybe now we can, I'll mention, you know, I touched on it just a moment ago, but I will mention now that he moves very freely from the Meir Nevuchim to the Zohar and back. In his understanding, it all fits into, it could be all woven together into one tapestry. It fits beautifully together, and in that regard, he anticipated a lot of modern thoughts. You know, a lot of, you know, Hasidim have delved in that a little bit, and but today it's more popular in understanding that it's just two different languages which are really addressing the same kind of concerns and work very well together. That's what Rav David HaNugget felt. And he, like I said, he quotes the Kabbalah, he quotes the Zohar, and he quotes Meir Nevuchim almost in the same breath. And that just shows you that he had synthesized various different disciplines. Now, I don't think that there are any pages of the Zohar in the Cairo Geniza that I'm aware of. So apparently he took his Zohar with him to Syria. But it's unique. It just shows you the size of his library, that he had a very rare safer for the time. It was only recently published in Spain. He had access to it, and he used it quite well. In fact, I'll just mention some of the interest today in Reb David HaNugget derives from one individual, a very fine individual, who sponsors Rabbi Zeval's research precisely because he believes that he's working on the same kind of synthesis himself between Hasidus, you know, the Kabbalistic Hasidus and the Rambam's thought and the Meir Nevuchim, and he's delighted with Reb David's brand of the synthesis, and that's why he's sponsoring this research and doing very good work in that regard.
Yeah, those, I think, the Machzerim, he published some Machzerim, Roshanim, Kippur, some others. Okay, Haggadah. So yeah. This kind of synthesis also, this is, I think, the classical example. This is the Ramah and Teres Ayla says that philosophy and Kabbalah is the same thing, just different languages. Yes. The Ramah famously says this in Teres Ayla.
Yes, so, he does. Now, I would mention, though, that the Ramah brings the Kabbalah more in line with the Zohar than, more in line with Meir Nevuchim, perhaps. You know, he understood the Zohar in a very philosophical way. But yeah, it is, you're right, that is an important signpost on the trail of synthesis.
So let's dive into this peerage a little bit. Something very interesting about it. You can it starts on Zion Hay in Be'era. But then it goes on, and in Pasuk Tes, so we're going to get into Moifes, Nisim, and then magic with the Mitzrayim, and the staff turning into a snake. There's a lot of really interesting things going on in the Psukim, in the Torah. And of course, something that's busy with philosophy, other chapshat, alikut, you know, there's going to be some really interesting things here. And I think actually, you know, so you can start where you want to talk about this. You actually, I think you told me you wanted to even put a subtitle. You didn't end up getting included in the chat, but what you wanted to have a subtitle in this.
I felt that perhaps, you know, besides for like, you know, we've been talking about till now, the importance and the novelty of this Sefer and Reb David Hanoga and bringing him to the attention of the Torah world, which is important enough in and of itself, I felt that another very important aspect of this work is the background it gives to a little understood part of the Rambam's Mahalach, the Rambam's Shita, and Rambam's Parshanus with regards to Kishif and magic and the occult. I feel that this is incredible. He cites from the Geonim, he cites from Reb Sadia, he cites from Rabbeinu Hananel, which is another lost Pirish, which he had access to, Rabbeinu Hananel's Pirish. He cites a snippet from Rabbi Yehuda Levi's lost Pirish, I believe, the Sefer HaKuzri. I believe he wrote a Pirish on Chumash. We never knew that till now, although the Ibn Ezra does cite him occasionally. We do know that Ibn Ezra was friendly with him, maybe related, according as legend would have it. We spoke about that on a different episode. So when Ibn Ezra cites him, we didn't know if it was from things that they had talked about or from an actual commentary, but from the fact that Reb David Hanoga quotes from Reb Yehuda Halevi, and apparently it's an idea that's similar to the Kuzri, but the citation is not to the Sefer HaKuzri. I think this is strong evidence that there was actually a commentary written by Reb Yehuda Halevi. So again, he cites these commentaries, which are very important, and they deal specifically with the issue of the Khartoumim and Mitzrayim, the Egyptians, and the kind of magic that they did. So I think that's, to me, that was a tremendously important part of this period. And I did actually, in my draft, I did include that byline that this includes fragments from the long-lost period of Rabbeinu Hananel and the Gaonim on Kishuf, Khartoumim, and the Kishuf of Mitzrayim. But the editors of this excellent journal felt that it was going to be too long, and they figured anyone scholarly enough to read the article will jump on that themselves, so they left that out. But I do want to talk about that, so thank you for bringing that up.
Okay, so obviously there's other stuff in this commentary, and you can mention it. There's just Stam Pshat Nepsukim, and he's quoting, as you mentioned, we get more in the sources, a lot of Ibn Ezra. Interesting, Rabbi Avram ben Harav HaMoira, so he calls him. There's a lot of interesting things, so we can get more into. But not to sensationalize it, but as you're saying, this is the interesting part of it, especially, like you said, it was understudied kind of thing. And just in general, that's more interesting. So we're going to talk about the magic and the moifsim. So first of all, he has some interesting things. Before we get to the magic, just the nisim here, that, right, he's a moifis. He takes the matting over a party, turns into a snake. So he brings him in Ochanan ben Choshil. So he starts talking about this. First of all, he talks about what's pshat in a snake? Why did he turn it into a snake? Why not into something else? And then he talks about the actual fact that it turned into a snake. And that kind of gets into what he's going to say about the Khatum. And he talks about the other nays. So maybe you want to talk about this a little bit.
Sure. So it's important to note that there were ultra-rationalists. And the irony is that these ultra-rationalists were spawned from the Rambam's Mor Nevuchim, but they take their rationalism further than the Rambam, and they reach conclusions that the Nisim and the Moifsim were not actually miracles, but they worked somehow. Obviously, it was Meis Hashem, it was the Yad Hashem that it should work, but they understood that it worked according to the rules of nature somehow. So it's important to state at the outset that Reb David Hanoga cites a contested letter, no doubt. It's the famous Igeres L'Rav Chizdoi. You know, it's printed in the back of Rav Shilat's edition of the Igeres HaRambam. This Igeres L'Rav Chizdoi, Rav Shilat casts aspersions on it, but I find time and time again, including this just adds to that. If But I find time again that it was viewed by Maimonideans, by his descendants, and by the Ramban and others. It was viewed as an authentic letter of the Rambam. So even though if the actual Nusach we have may not have been penned by the Rambam, it clearly does contain Maimonidean thoughts, including some Chidushim. And Reb David Hanagid relies on this twice in the fragment that I published. He relies on that. He doesn't identify that as the Gersh letter of Chazdei, but he says, like the Rambam wrote in a response to him, and he's referring to that letter. So he relies on that letter right away to tell you that we do not deny the miraculous nature of any of the Maifsim in the Chumash. If they're written as Maifsim, then we take them as Maifsim, and they are miraculous. And including turning it into the snake, that is miraculous. Later at the end of the PRC, he emphasizes the fish would not die when the water was turned to blood if it wasn't actually blood. Contra the Chartumim, who only gave it the appearance of blood, because he holds that their magic was a sleight of hand and a farce. But the Maifas did actually turn it on, and that is why the fish died. So he does emphasize that. And he makes a point, which the Rambam also makes, in his writings against Galen, and he hints at it in the Maariv Vuchim as well, that if we believe in Chiddush HaOlam, if we believe that the world was created Shmeayin, then all the philosophers would agree that as an outgrowth of that is the belief in the veracity of Isis and Maisim and miracles. So he does stress that at the outset.
Right, and he said, I want to read a little bit, just to paraphrase or to read, that he says, he quotes, and as you note in your footnote, that you know who he's referring to someone, it says, lo he goes through it. So he says what you just said. He's quoting. If not for the Torah told you for a fact that he took it, it became to a snake. You know, Iram Kach. Elam Achash Apirish Akosif. The fact that the pasuk says Vamatash Nebuch Lanachash ain't Lano Lomer. We shouldn't say Lavada Kash Baruch Bigvurasai. In his strength, Kasha Yochel of Reisai is able to create Kach Hafacha Eitz Lebriyai, turned the wood into a creation, Yesh Baruch Hayim, that's alive. Then he says, She'ein Hefresh Bein Eitz Lafer. What is the difference between wood and dirt? Shekashim Shenivram and Afar Bria, created person from dirt, Kach Bayram and Eitz Bria, created from the wood Bria. Ukashim Shu Mashivam Oid Lafer, and he returns it back to Afar Kedich Sev. I'm going to butcher the pasuk over here. Kach lo hinashi v'nachash l'mata. He's saying, just as close to him, just like he returned man, so he returned the nachash also. So what's the difference? So avada, the pasuk tells us, that's what it is. Now he brings the Ibn Ezra, he brings the Rambam, as you just mentioned. But then he's going to go talk about in Zayin Yod Aleph, v'kukam parei l'chacham l'machash v'yasu gam heim chartumim mitzrayim v'lotayim kain. And then he's going to get involved. So now here comes the magicians doing their thing. Oh, hold on. Now it's not an ace. So now talk about that. Now already it's a different thing.
All right. So some perspective here. The Rambam is well known. The Rambam's rejection of magic is well known, even though that's been contested too. I've got to say, but it's some people have said when he says it's not true, he means true on a metaphysical level. It's not ultimate truth, but it does have some degree. You know, people have tried to say that, but the Vilna Gaon knew clearly, and he jumps on the Rambam for this famously. But the Rambam writes, he writes in Pirshei Mishnayos, he writes in Maariv Vuchim, and he writes it in the Mishnah Torah. He says Jewish people who are brought up on Torah, they're brought up on the Chachma, true Chachma, they should not fall for the shtus that the Goyim believe in and believe that there's anything real about magic. That's the Rambam's famous formulation. Magic is a bunk, not true at all. And despite the fact that there's many Gemaras and Agarata and certainly Midrashim, which do seem to relate to magic as a true and real phenomenon, the Rambam is forced to explain them allegorically or some other, he doesn't address them specifically, but he will have to explain them away because he is very adamant that he does not believe that there's anything real about magic. Now, the Vilna Gaon in his comments on Yeridea calls the Rambam out for this. He calls out the Rama for relying on the Rambam as well in this regard. And he says it's just the philosophy that the Rambam learned led him astray. It made him explain the Divrei Chazal, not according to the simple meaning. but it's ridiculous, and the Rambam himself would be forced to regret taking such a position, because the words of Chazal are true and real, and if they believe and say magic is real, then of course magic is real. So the Gaon apparently blames this on Rambam alone, thinking this is the Rambam alone. Now, he may have been aware that it wasn't just the Rambam, but that didn't bother him at all. But to put it in, yeshiva people are not aware that the Rambam is not alone. They just, they only know about this controversy, in the terms laid out by the Vilna Gaon. However, it's important to note that this is not the Rambam's own approach. It's the Rambam coming from the school that he grew up in, and the Gaonic school, the Sephardic Andalusian school, hints of which actually were available in the Pirush of Rabbeinu Bachai and but again, those are just hints. They're not extensively addressing the issue, and that's why people can come away with the impression that it's the Rambam's own Chiddush. However, it's not the Rambam's own Chiddush, and nothing brings it out more than now that we have these citations where it's as clear as day. This is what Reb Sadia held, and Rabbeinu Chananel echoed Reb Sadia, as did Rabbi Yehuda Levi, and of course Ibn Ezra did. So the Rambam is part of a very established tradition in his rejection of magic.
Now, okay, perfect. So now you have that introduction. So now, again, going to this getting to the magicians now, the Mitzrayim.
I think maybe a little bit more background is in order, and I would note that however the Rambam's philosophy, the Rambam's whole Mahalach of Machshava it is more extensive than the information we have from the other sources, and it extends beyond magic. Just to put it briefly, the Rambam's understanding of the metaphysical is that there can be no blending of the physical world, the physical reality, the real and true, the world that we experience with our senses, that cannot blend at all with the world of the supernatural. There's a very strong line of demarcation which cannot be crossed. And this extends to various different issues in the Rambam's thought, which are brought out in the Pirush of Avram. Again, the Rambam he doesn't tie it together himself. He leaves that for the student to tie it together. But if you learn all the Rambams in context and take him at his word, and especially if you study the background, the other, and the Gaonim, and again, down to Rabbi Rambam and Rambam, who also goes with this Mahalach, so you'll see that it's the Briah HaTichon in the Rambam's his thought process, that there's a very clear separation. And that's why Malachim, the Rambam holds, Malachim cannot be experienced in the physical world. Anytime there's a Malach, it's a dream, it's a Mara Nevuah. Malachim cannot appear to someone in the physical world. If there's talk of a Malach, so either it happens in a vision, or the Malach is not a spiritual being at all. The Malach is an agent of Hashem, and anything can serve as an agent of Hashem. The wind, the Pasuk calls it agent of Hashem. So that's the Rambam's approach to Malachim. That touches on the very famous debate which came up a few weeks ago in Parshas Vayechi with asking Bakushas from Malachim. Who was Yaakov addressing when he said HaMalach HaGo LLC? It's a very long, extensive discussion about Malachim. Maybe we can talk about that another time. This relates also to the Shekhinah. According to the common perception, Shekhinah is it's Hashem's manifestation. It's in this world, in the physical world. But according to the Rambam, the physical world you cannot experience Hashem. Hashem has to be, to physical has to go to reach the physical. It has to go through a series of filtrations, which the Rambam discusses in Yisrael Atayr. So, it's the common line of thought, and it touches at magic as well. Magic is supernatural in this world, unless it's a nace. Hashem can alter the rules of this world, but if it's not a specific nace from Hashem altering the rules of nature, then we have to assume that the world only works according to the rules of nature, and magic, which contravenes nature, cannot be real. That is, so it definitely fits very well with the Rambam's philosophy, but he's not alone in that. And this rationalist approach to magic was the approach that the Rambam grew up on, and that was shared by all the Talmid Chacham from Reb Sadia Dan, where he comes from.
Okay, so then therefore, Reb David picks up on this pasuk, Zayin Yud Aleph, and he quotes the Ibn Ezra and Ibn Chananel about the Chatumim, what they did.
Right. So it's this is the very pasuk that the Vilna Gaon uses in his in contradicting the Rambam. He says, well, the pasuk clearly talks about it says they did things bilateim. They did things with their sorcery and with the occult. And so how can you say they didn't? And the truth is, though the Rambam doesn't talk about the pasuk, but now we see the sources that this is exactly the question dealt with by Rabbi Sadia Gaon and Rabbeinu Chananel. I want to note, by the way, that Rabbeinu Chananel, it's been long suspected by the scholarly community that the Pirush of Rabbeinu Chananel was likely a Hebrew adaptation of Rabbi Sadia Gaon. I think maybe I touched on this in the earlier podcast, but these fragments from Rabbi David HaNagid bring that out very clearly because he cites them side by side. And he says, he'll say a piece from Rabbi Sadia, and he says, and Rabbeinu Chananel writes the same thing in his commentary, where Rabbeinu Chananel writes this, and that was the Lashon of Rabbi Sadia. And sometimes he quotes them both, and you can compare them. So now we know that this is borne out, that it really was quite a bit of overlap between Rabbi Sadia's Pirush and Rabbeinu Chananel's Pirush. But on this pasuk in particular, they address this very question. The pasuk says they did with their lahateim. What did they do? If magic is false, magic is fake, magic cannot be real. So what is the pasuk referring to? And they take it as axiomatic that magic is fake. That was obvious to them, and therefore they have to contend with the pasuk now. And Rabbi Sadia says that to do doesn't, we think of doing, the word asiya, as something that results in a creation. That's in Hebrew, it does often mean that. But he says vayas doesn't have to mean, it can mean going through the motions, doing actions, empty actions, that dry actions that do not result in actual accomplishment can also be called asiya, says Rabbi Sadia Gaon, and he proves it from the parsha itself by the kinim. It says they tried vayas gamheim, but it didn't work. So he says you can sometimes see that asiya can refer just to the dry run without any results. And that's what he says happened here. It says the fact that it says gamheim, they also did it, which seems to be comparing it to Moshe Rabbeinu. He said sometimes the comparison is to denigrate the one in comparison to the other. And to say they tried, they thought they were doing exactly Moshe Rabbeinu, and really it was no dimyon at all. Moshe Rabbeinu was real. It was a moifis. It was a nais. While the Chatumim, what they did was absolute bunk, sleight of hand, and worthless. So they're using the very same pasuk, and they address, in effect, they address the Vilna Gaon's question, and they dispatch the raya from this pasuk.
Right. So interestingly, like I said, he quotes Ibn Ezra, then he quotes Ibn Chananel, the Chen Amr. It's a whole long thing, but you have a lot of notes here. And then he says, at the end, v'zeh kulei gam kein loshen agoyin Reb Sadia Zal, v'amar agoyin Reb Sadia Zal. Okay, it continues. Now, this gets us into the next thing, where he gets involved as a shadim. He gets involved in demons now. Suddenly, he goes into... he quotes Reb Sadia, v'omer ha-goyin Reb Sadia, l'izdam ha-maisim ha-yishav aron, l'mais ha-chatumim. So he quotes... This is what you just said. I'm sorry, that's what you just said. I'm trying to find where he says... v'omer razal, then he says, he quotes the Gemara in Sanhedrin, b'latem, I should say b'latem, b'latem, ma'is ha-shedim, b'latem ma'is ha-kshafim, v'tzarech kol maskil his-oyr, l'zeh ha-dover, every maskil, a smart person has to think about this, v'anim ha-idiyacha k'koyach ha-medame, nikra shedim.
So what is he doing
explain
here?
Explain here what's going on over here. Yeah, what is going on? How did he get involved suddenly to shade him, and what is he talking about here? And is this him talking himself?
This is him talking. This is actually a rare occurrence where he editorializes at length and adds himself. You know, it's like I mentioned, the Gaon do address the pasuk of Vayas Chatumim Bilateim, but they don't address the Divrei Chazal. And Reb David HaNagid now comes to address Divrei Chazal. He says, Chazal and Sanhedrin famously say, they say that there's a difference in the pasuk. One, in the first time it uses this word, it says Lahateim with a hey, and then after it says Lateim without a hey. So Chazal say one is kshafim and one is ma'isa shedim. So what are we to make of that? If it's all sleight of hand, then it's all nothing. So what exactly are Chazal referring to? So Reb David HaNagid here is answering the Gaon's second complaint that he levels against the Rambam and explaining the Divrei Chazal as it would be understood according to Maimonidean thought. Now, what exactly he means is somewhat ambiguous because he gets philosophical here and he does not actually connect all the dots. He leaves it for you. And so it's somewhat unclear. I wrote what I think is the pshat in my notes. I actually consulted with Professor Warren Zev Harvey, and I quoted his response as well in my notes. He had another way of looking at it, so it's not entirely clear. I'll just give the brief outline, and if someone wants further research, I would encourage them to look at the source themselves and see what I wrote and see and maybe they can come up with an even better pshat. But what he does, he does say clearly that when Chazal refer to Shadim, they're referring to the function of the imagination. Not that, you know, we know from others that say that Shadim are the fruit of the imagination, that the demons only exist in your imagination. But he's not saying that that exactly. He's saying that the function of the imaginative faculty is what Chazal referred to as Shadim. We know that the Rambam categorizes different parts of your brain. Primarily, there's the intellectual faculty and the imaginative faculty. And and both are necessary, the Rambam says, to reach Nevuah. And it's a part of the Mer Nevuchim, which Reb David cites here in his own translation, by the way. It's of interest to linguists and Mer Nevuchim scholars. Here we have a translation in Hebrew by Reb David Hanoge to this part of the Rambam in Chelek Sheni, where he talks about the imaginative faculty and the intellectual faculty. And he says for a Navi to be able to produce a Nevuah, he's got to be using both faculties perfectly. He's got to be using his well-developed intellectual faculty as well as his well-honed imaginative faculty. Both together produce a Nevuah. If someone only exercises the intellectual faculties of the Rambam, quoted by Reb David Hanoge, then that will be a very big chacham. He'll be a big, he'll be very wise, and he'll master a lot of disciplines, intellectual disciplines. But without the imaginative faculty, he's not going to get beyond. He's not going to be able to, you know, use it for any practical benefits. The Rambam has a broader understanding of the function of the imagination than we do, I think, because he says if someone only has the imaginative faculty working well for him, that will produce charisma, that will produce keen political acumen. That person will have leadership qualities. Against us, you know, that's, I don't know if we would call that the fruit of the imaginative faculty, but the Rambam does. These qualities derive in the Rambam's conception from the imaginative faculty, and such a person can use his charisma and can use these talents for even predicting the future. You know, the Rambam was aware that even though magic is fake, there are people that, there's fortune tellers, and it works with some degree of success. There's people that can dream future events. How does that work according to the Rambam if it's not Nevuah? So the Rambam understands that's the function of the imaginative faculty. Just like Hashem provides a beam, you know, you understand it with radio waves of intellect on a person's active intellect, on the person's imaginative faculty can also receive inspiration from on high, which will affect, his ability to do these imaginative qualities. So what does that all mean as far as Kishef? I don't know for certain. What does it mean for Shadim? Again, I don't know for certain. What do you do with all the Gemaras that talk about Shadim? Are they all allegorical? It would seem so. It would seem that's what Reb David means, that these Gemaras are to be understood allegorically. They're referring to this Shefa of on the imagination. Perhaps, Reb David doesn't say this himself, but the Rambam does talk about Hashem's Shefa on the intellect as being the work of Malachim. That's what the Rambam writes in Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah, about 10 degrees of Malachim, which Mekubalim understand as 10 spheres. But the Rambam talks about the 10 degrees of filtration of Hashem's heavenly, godly intellect being beamed into the physical world, going through the filtration process. He calls that's the Malachim, that's the function of Malachim. Perhaps David Hanoge means to suggest that when the beam is focusing imaginative energy on the imagination, that is what he calls Shadim. It may be that that's the counterpart to Malachim. Not clear to me. But it is clear that he's addressing this Gemara, and he's saying that when it talks about Shadim, when it talks about Kishef, it's referring to real Hashpa from Hashem on this on people who've honed their imaginative faculties. But it does not result, and he's clear on this point, it doesn't result in anything real in the physical, sensible world.
Okay, so this is all on page 201 to 203 in Mechilta, in your article, and footnote 75 and 76, really, record Professor Harvey and others that anyone interested can see. And we'll talk about where people can access this later on at the end of the episode. Okay, now one last thing on this pasuk is that he quotes Rabbi Yehuda Levi that you mentioned. He quotes Rabbi Yehuda Levi's opinion on this.
Now, Rabbi Yehuda Levi also clearly writes, now, and again, in Kuzri, he hints it, but the hints have been lost by people who couldn't imagine that that's what they were seeing. You know, people who think that, you know, the Rambam is an outlier in saying that Kishuv is only, the rabbinic preferred is achizas einayim, sleight of hand. That's the Rambam's outlying position, but nobody else held that. So when they came across a slight reference in Kuzri to the, you know, to Kishuv being imagination, and when you investigate it, you see it's really nothing. They could understand that in terms, like we mentioned earlier, in, you know, kind of the metaphysical reality, not really saying it's nothing, but not lasting, it's not substantial, it's not meaningful. That's how they may have understood the Kuzri. But in this reference in David HaNagid's commentary, it's similar to what he writes in Kuzri, but it's much more clear. And importantly, it's addressing these psukim just like the Goyim did. He's addressing exactly what lahat means and what lateya means. And he's very adamant that it means it's nothing. They move quickly. Their actions are very quick to produce the sleight of hand, to produce the illusory impression that something's going on, but really nothing's going on. So here it lays bare Rabbi Yehuda Levi's opinion. Now Rabbi Yehuda Levi is very his hashkaf is not pro philosophical as the Rambam's is. And one Rosh Yeshiva said that Rabbi Yehuda Levi's philosophy is our philosophy of the yeshiva world. And in a lot of respects, it is, particularly with Bechiras Yisrael and Nevuah and Maimon Harsina. In a lot of respects, it is. But in this respect, at least, it shows that there is some divide with Rabbi Yehuda Levi still reflecting the upbringing, the Andalusian Gaonic upbringing where he operated, where it was taken as axiomatic that Kishuv is just sleight of hand.
Okay, so there's that. It's obviously fascinating. It's really interesting to read it inside and to read your notes on this. And there's obviously much more. If you don't have anything else that you want to specifically mention, again, there's a lot of quoting of Ibn Ezra.
I want to clarify that this is not intended to give any more weight to one position over another. I mean, especially with the advent of Kabbalah, which is why this is significant in Reb David, who does have the Zohar, but he still understands the Zohar is working in tandem with his upbringing with the Mori Nevuchim. But the vast majority of Reb Minyan Ubinyan of Chachmei Yisrael understood these midrashim literally. The Goyim's Messiah has been canonized today, and nothing I said should be construed as running counter to that. I'm just trying to show what Reb David understood, what the Rambam understood, what the Goyim before him understood, and for what it's worth, that's their shita, and we can better appreciate the other shita when we have the contrast in front of us clearly.
Yeah, I want to add to that. I would hope that the listeners of Sfarim Chatter understand that at this point in the podcast, however many episodes we are in, 100, you know, close to 200 episodes, where I try to give credence, I guess, or not to give credence to anything. Meaning to say that both sides, you know, we try to just balance that. We're just pointing out, especially an interesting reason that you brought to light, and just to discuss it, not to give it especially more credence. Say, oh, this is what, that's not what we're trying to do here.
Exactly.
No one should think that's what we're trying to do, because we're absolutely not. And I've had episodes of many other before Sheikh Chumash, and the plan is, in Mirz Hashem, to have many more on that in the future, just to mention that for the listeners. Right. But anyways, exactly, just to mention this. So, and again, he just, you know, this is something, you know, quotes a lot of other things. Ibn Ezra here, he's quoting Ramban, Ibn Hanan, a lot of this. Okay, so I don't know if anything else specifically you want to mention, but the other thing that we should, first of all, it ends, it's only a fragment, so it ends by Makas Dam. Now, the commentary that you, the fragment that you printed. Now, the other thing is sources used. So we've kind of mentioned a whole bunch over here, but if you want to just talk about talk a little bit more about it, even though we kind of discussed that.
Yeah, it's interesting that you just said the Ramban. One thing that jumped out at me, the way he quotes the Ramban, he quotes a one line from the Ramban, and then he says V'chulu. And typically, Reb David quotes very extensively, verbatim, from commentaries. But by the Ramban, he says V'chulu, etc. He does that also with Ibn Ezra's long pirish, which is what we would call the normative, the standard pirish. But none of the other sources does he do that. To me, that's strongly indicative of the fact that his readers, he expected, had an Ibn Ezra, you know, this again before the age of printing, before the Makrish Gedalus, but they did have, he believed they had Ramban and they had Ibn Ezra's standard pirish, and he felt no need to quote it at length like he did with the other pirish. And he just ends off, etc. And let's, you know, you can look it up yourself. That is significant to me. It shows you the spread and influence of the Ramban. Other sources that he quotes, when he talks about Rabbeinu Hananel, you know, the standard Rabbeinu Hananel, he refers to him as Rabbeinu Hananel ben Chushiel. He adds the last name, doesn't do that typically by the others. And he does that to differentiate with another Rabbeinu Hananel that he quotes, and that's Rabbeinu Hananel Hadayan. Rabbeinu Hananel Hadayan we discovered him recently, and piecing different Gnezer fragments together, the scholars were able to discover that he was the father-in-law of Rabbeinu Avram ben Aramba. This Rabbeinu Hananel Hadayan. Rabbeinu Hananel ben Shmuel. Elsewhere in other writings of Rabbi David HaNugget, he calls him Rabbeinu Hananel Jidana. Jido is the Arabic word for a grandfather. So usually they don't use terms of you don't use relations. When he refers to Rabbi Avram ben Aram, for example, he just calls him Rabbi Avram, the son of the Meira. When he refers to the Ram, he just says Harav HaMeira. So he doesn't usually stress the familiar relation. But in the case of Rabbeinu Hananel, he does stress that it's an ancestor of his, probably to differentiate between Rabbeinu Hananel, his ancestor, and Rabbeinu Hananel, the famous Rabbeinu Hananel, whose last name was Rabbeinu Hananel ben Chushiel. Other Pirushim that come up, it doesn't come up in our fragment, but in the Bereshis fragment, there's the long lost commentary of the Radak's father, Rabbi Yosef Kimchi. He quotes from quite a bit, and that should be very significant for those interested in putting that together. He quotes a Mefarish that I don't know who he is. He quotes Rabbi Tzadik. I don't know who that is. I've looked around a little bit. I don't know if anyone knows who he is. But it's somebody that he quotes often in the Bereshis commentary. So it's apparently an important Pirish, but we don't know who it is outside of Rabbi David's citations. So there's a wealth of material just in his citations, apart from the important topics that we've touched on here tonight.
Okay, and as you mentioned, there are some things that are unique that we know just from this commentary in Vayera, and we'll talk maybe a little bit more about the Bereshis in a minute. So the manuscript, this fragment that you published here, is this the first time it was published, and where is this fragment from?
This is the first time it was published. It's categorized as part of the Gnezer documents. This particular fragment, as well as the Bereshis one, are part of the St. Petersburg collection, which was... comes from Firkovich's Geniza collection, the provenance of which is somewhat dubious. You've had Dr. Jefferson talk about that. She's got the book, which I recommend if someone wants to know more about where the different pieces came from and how they all came to be known as the Geniza. But what's important for our purposes is that these fragments were unstudied and unknown because they were part of the Firkovich collection. And then stuck behind the Iron Curtain, scholars did not have access to them. So to the best of my knowledge, they're not cited, they're not quoted, and I almost certainly they were not published, aside for this publication, I believe, is the first publication of this Sefer.
Okay, now what about the Bereshis? You mentioned the Bereshis. Is that the only other fragment that we have, and was that one ever published?
There's a few smaller pages. There's one page that's in another library, which is available on, you can see it with the Friedberg Knesset portal. It's one page on Parshas Vayishlach. There's also another separate a bunch of pages on Bereshis, which are part of the Firkovich collection in St. Petersburg. But they are part of the. It's separated, but it does seem to be part of the same Bereshis, the longer Bereshis section. But other than that, I don't know of any other fragments. So basically, it's just this one and the Bereshis one.
Are you planning on publishing the Bereshis one?
I would very much like to, given the time, energy, and resources. It's something I would like to do. I've already mined it for its citations of Rabbeinu Avram ben Arambam, most of which do overlap with the peers that we have. Like I mentioned on the last podcast, Rabbi David HaNugget is the only one that had Rabbeinu Avram ben Arambam Sefer, and he uses it liberally in his own commentary. So there were a few instances I was able to put together, which I hope in the future edition will supplement the missing parts of Rabbi Avraham Rambam that I called from this larger Bereishis fragment. So that work I've done already. I've transcribed the separate pages on Bereishis, which were very hard to read because apparently the pages had stuck together, so the ink had run over from one page to the other. I imagine if I ever get access to the originals, I'll probably be able to improve my transcription. But I worked very hard on transcribing those pages. So I would very much like to. Haven't advanced very much yet, but Mirat Hashem, given the time and energy, I do hope to.
And you said that Bereishis one wasn't published either.
No, that wasn't published.
So, and why the interest? Why did you decide to publish this one, Parashas Vayera? Was it because the connection to the Rambam's family again?
It's the Rambam's family, in particular, because I had written in my notes, I had pieced together the Goyim sheet on Kishuf. That's actually what drew me to this. I had pieced it together from the scant references and their hints. I had pieced together their sheet and I'd written about it. And I actually, I had to deal with some criticism on this front. People were, you know, even with what I thought I had built a good case, they still weren't prepared to accept that there was anyone other than the Rambam that had subscribed to this position. When I found this, I thought this is very, very significant. That was one of the main reasons I thought it would be very important to publish this now. But again, it's Parshanus, it's Chumash, it's from the Rambam's family. It's otherwise lost, and I can't get enough of it.
Okay, and there's a short introduction, and then you go through, you actually lay out the Makaris, the meaning, the sources, who he quotes, and you have them actually in bold, to Targum Munkelis, Sajagoyin, Rabbeinu Ben Janach, Rabbeinu Chananel, so you have it laid out in the beginning, and then you have the commentary with your notes, and again, it's in the Mechilta, volume 4, so Mechilta, I will mention, it's a paperback journal, it's the fourth volume, some really fascinating material in these Mechilta volumes. Where it's available? It's available definitely through Eliezer Brat. I can put his email in the show's notes. And Beagle Eisen had it. I don't know if he still does. I'm not sure if it's available elsewhere here. And I believe if anyone's interested for Parashas Vayera, so even though, like I said, the journal is worth getting, but for Parashas Vayera, if they can't get it now, this is on your Academia page, I believe, correct?
Yes, I did upload this article to my Academia page. I know they weren't keen on me distributing it before they finished selling, but I think by now they did. They gave me permission to put it on my Academia page, and I think by now they probably have relaxed that restriction to a large degree.
Okay, and like I said, I'll put Eliezer Brat's email for those that don't know it. I'm sure many do know it and who listen to this podcast, and you can email him and get a copy of it. It's not expensive. It's paperback. It has some really nice material in here, and the first three as well, some really interesting and important material. So you can check out the journals. And also, Moshe, again, if people don't know your email address, they can email you. If you want to say your email again, I can put your email again. If they have any comments and questions on this episode, any ideas for any future episodes for us to do, I can mention already, we finally got a hold of the third edition of Magal Torah for David Mandelbaum. So we are in the process of reviewing that. Maybe we'll have an addendum to our Magal Torah episode, although the Raviv second one hasn't come out yet, but you know, we'll see. Maybe some other ideas if listeners have some other ideas, and so on. All right.
Thank you very much, Nachi. Like I said, it's really an honor and a privilege to share, Torah thoughts with your audience, and I hope our efforts here work lahagdil Torah la'adira, and I hope they're appreciated. And for me, it's a very wonderful experience. Thank you very much, Nachi.
Okay, thank you for joining me. And yeah, hopefully it is lahagdil Torah la'adira, and it's to bring to light a commentary, a leaflet of a Rishon that's more unknown, that people didn't know of, and didn't know of him, his story, or his commentary, and they can get to know more and more of this, Sephardi style, like we said, talking about one style of just to something else to mention, and we'll talk about the different commentary, something else next time. So thank you, Ramesha, once again.
Excellent. Thank you. Have a good night.